guess my first question was just what really defines a singular kind of, or a universal flu vaccine? Is it a singular vaccine for everyone? Is there variation between, for example, age or other demographics, something like that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, what defines a universal vaccine from the standpoint of protection is that a universal vaccine should protect from any type of influenza, any type of drift variants. It shouldn't be problematic if the virus changes from year to year. It should still protect. It should also protect against new pandemic viruses that occur. And it should also protect from zoonotic infections, which sometimes occur, like with H7N9 in China, right? That's from the protection point of view. How a formulation would look like is a different story, but the idea would be that it's similar in terms of the age ranges, similar to what we have now for flu vaccines, which is basically, I think, for the live attenuated vaccine, starting at 2 years and then going up to, I believe, 49, and then the inactivated vaccines have a little bit more extended age range, I think, starting from, don't quote me on that, but I think they start at, you can give them already at 6 months or 1 year, and then they go up to basically the elderly. So obviously you would want to protect everybody with such a vaccine, but how the final formulation and how a final regimen would look like for vaccination is not clear yet. A little bit too early for that, but in terms of protection, it should protect against any type of influenza.
Okay, and so you you mentioned pandemic situations. How does a universal, how does that adapt to that situation better than, I know what we have now is not particularly, isn't as effective as we would want in terms of you know, a pandemic type situation.
Although the current vaccines do not protect at all against pandemic, new pandemic viruses, there's no protection. To make the vaccine, and then it takes a little bit more to actually use it, right? Because you need, usually for pandemic vaccines, you need to get two shots. And so it takes another like 6 weeks until you're protected. So, you know, seven and a half months. And that's, at least in my opinion, unacceptable. So the issue is the following. There's this surface glycoprotein that the virus has, right? Hemagglutinin. And you can actually imagine it like a mushroom. There's a cap and there's a stalk of the mushroom. And so the cap is the part that regular vaccines target. And so what the cap does, it binds to your cells. And so if there's an antibody that targets the cap of the mushroom, there's no binding to your cells, the virus is inhibited, and you're protected. The problem is that that cap changes all the time. So that's where the antigenic drift happens. And it's completely different if you look at that mushroom cap, compare a current seasonal virus with a virus that might cause the next pandemic. So they're completely different. And that's why it doesn't work. The vaccine doesn't help in this case. But the mushroom also has a stalk and it's closer to the membrane, and that is much more conserved. There's actually epitopes in there that are cross-conserved from, let's say, an H1 strain, which is a seasonal influenza virus strain, and an H5 strain, which is a highly pathogenic avian influenza strain. And so if you get antibodies against that domain, they can actually protect you against both viruses because there's so much conservation there. That the antibodies recognize both. And so that would be the basis for at least our universal influenza vaccine candidate.
Yeah, so that targeting the stalk is
exactly.
Is what makes this approach to developing a universal vaccine sort of unique?
Exactly. So this stalk is relatively conserved. Our immune system doesn't like to target it, and current vaccines basically don't induce antibodies against it, only against the head or the cap of the mushroom. But if you can, with a vaccine, redirect the immune response against that stalk, you can actually get very broad protection against all kinds of influenza viruses.
All right. What do you think would be the impact for clinicians, patients, and just kind of global health in general to have this universal vaccine achieved in the future?
Well, there are many implications. The first one is the vaccination rates in the U.S. for flu vaccines are not that low compared to other countries, but they're low compared to other vaccines, right? And one of the reasons for that is people don't want to get vaccinated every year. It's, you know, you have to go to the doctor's office or a pharmacy, you need to get the vaccine. That, you know, if you would have a vaccine that you would only get, and that's the idea, maybe two or three times in your life, like other vaccines, again, I don't know, measles or, you know, tetanus, well, tetanus is not a good example, but measles, for example, or mumps, then, you know, people would get vaccinated as kids and many more people would get vaccinated and there would be more herd immunity and there would probably be less circulation of the virus in the population. So that is important. And then obviously in a pandemic situation, you wouldn't have to wait for a vaccine and then quickly vaccinate people. You already have vaccinated people that are immune against that virus. From a global health perspective, it's actually a pretty, pretty big deal. The problem here is that, you know, flu vaccines are not used in most low and middle income countries, right? So they're typically used in the US and in Europe. And one of the reasons, or the main reason for that is, you know, you need an infrastructure to roll out a vaccine every year and you have to pay for it. And again, if you have a vaccine that you only give two or three times, for example, to children, you could give that at the same time when measles vaccine is given or when, I don't know, diphtheria vaccine is given, right? So it's much easier to roll that out. And so having a vaccine like that would actually make the vaccine globally available.
Yeah. All right. That's really interesting from a sort of international economic point of view there. Last two sort of things, and then I'm just going to open the floor sort of, but what would you say the concrete takeaway progress that's been made as a result of this study thus far? Like, where are we now in terms of the process?
Well, I mean, it's the first time such a vaccine has been tested in humans, right? So, and those are the results that we are publishing right now in Lancet of Infectious Disease are basically the interim results of that study with the final results going to be available soon. And we will try to publish them early next year. The interesting thing there is that it seems that the concept works. We can induce these antibodies. There is not much more you can say right now because obviously with a phase one study, you cannot look at protection. And we are missing a lot of the immunological readouts that we'll get with the full study report. But it's already a good sign that the concept works and we could induce these antibodies, right? So, you know, the impact of the study is that it's really the first time that anybody has done that. There's one more study that just started last in March 2019 at the NIH that has a similar concept. To induce these dog reactive antibodies, and then there's a company, Crucell, that also is going to start a clinical trial with a similar concept. So, I mean, we're the first ones to actually test this, and the results look pretty interesting and pretty positive so far. I mean, again, it's a limited data set. And from the interim analysis, we've also seen that there wasn't really a safety signal, right, which is important because that's why you do phase one trial. You want to see if there's safety issues. And we can't say by vaccine group because we only had aggregated safety data, but it didn't seem that there were any kind of issues, at least in that small group. So that's kind of the takeaway. We're moving forward. We have an approach that seems to be working in humans, and that's really important because, you know, I can protect mice against almost everything, but if that then translates into humans, it's a completely different story. So it's a step in the right direction, and it's encouraging to kind of continue with these constructs, I think, and not just for us, but also for other like the NIH, for other entities that have similar vaccines, because it wasn't really clear if, you know, with a vaccine you can induce these antibodies, and now we know.
Great. So is there anything else you want to include or discuss?
Well, not really. I mean, what I wanted to stress is, like, the study has a lot of authors, right? So it was really a collaboration between three groups here, Peter Blazy's lab, Adolfo Garcia Sastre's lab, and my lab. And then we had really great partners with PATH who were helping or conducting the or organizing the clinical trial. And then it was done at two sites, right, in Cincinnati and in at Duke. So that's what I want to highlight, because you can't do things like that without having a great team and great collaborations. But on the scientific side, yeah, it's really exciting. There's a lot of interest in this right now, and I'm sure we're going to make a lot of progress, and we made a lot of progress since 2009 when people first found these antibodies, right? But unfortunately, you know how it is with vaccine development. It's relatively conservative and relatively slow, because you have to be careful about, you know, safety, doing everything right.